What is beyond the world?
The film The New World was an arresting tale of a passionate love between Indian Princess Pocahontas and the English adventurer John Smith. But historians say there never was any romance between Pocahontas and Smith, and that even Smith's account of the Indian princess saving his life isn't quite right. I'm Sarah McConnell, and this is New Perspectives on Jamestown. Today, how the Pocahontas myth evolved, and what the Indian world of 1607 was really like. When Captain John Smith and his English cohort stepped ashore in Virginia in 1607, up to 25,000 Indians are believed to have been living in the coastal plain. But in almost no time at all, they nearly vanished. Today, Virginia Indians take pride in their heritage and are using the 400th anniversary of the arrival of the English to tell their side of the story. Keith Smith of the Nansemond Indian tribe and Sue Elliott, a Monacan Indian, say Native people have a much different view of that first contact.
The English would have died if it hadn't have been for us. They held us as being savage and pagan and backward and uncivilized, and they couldn't even feed themselves and were unwilling to do the work to feed themselves. The white man wanted to Christianize the Indian, thinking that we were pagan and, you know, not close to God, but I tend to believe that we were a lot closer to God than they thought we were. As a matter of fact, I believe we were a lot closer to God than they were.
Respect for the land is one of the most important things that Native people are still trying to give to the Europeans and other people in the world. Our Creator provides us with everything we need. We do not have to abuse it.
I have mixed feelings towards Pocahontas. On the one part, she was a catalyst for peace amongst the Indians and the English. But on the other part, I feel that she was somewhat of a traitor as well. There was at least one time that she warned the English that we were going to attack them. And a lot of people don't know that. I often wonder why she felt the need to do that.
I felt that she wanted to make these two groups of people, the Europeans and the Indian people, work together as a team. And she knew that no matter what happened, they were going to stay. They were going to continue to come into our world as we knew it. And the only way to survive was to help her people try to understand these other people and their way of thinking and their way of doing things. This is what their world is like. Be prepared.
We've all heard the colorful names of the great Indian chiefs of America's West. Names like Sitting Bull, Geronimo, Crazy Horse, and Tecumseh. But much less is commonly known about the Mattapani, the Pamunkey, and the Monacans. These are just a few of the eastern native people who first saw the English settlers land on the shores of the Chesapeake Bay 400 years ago. Helen Rountree and Camilla Townsend are among the foremost scholars of East Coast Indians. Rountree is the author of numerous works, including Pocahontas, Powhatan, and Opican Canoe. Camilla Townsend is the author of Pocahontas and the Powhatan Dilemma. Helen, what was the Indian world like in 1607? Who were these people who had their first encounter with the Europeans?
They were people who had been there for centuries, even millennia, for starters. They were non-immigrants, which is how they saw the English, immigrants.
What was their world like?
Well, their world was interlaced fingers of land and water, and they knew how to use every single square inch of it. But most of the place would have been forested, and that's the first thing the English noticed.
Certainly the English, when they approached the shore, were, as we would say, bowled over by what they saw. Coming from England, of course, they were always looking for forest land. Most of England had been cleared, and only great lords had forests preserved for their hunting, essentially, with some exceptions.
And what did they describe that they saw when they disembarked?
They were almost ravished at the sight, the way George Percy put it. John Smith later wrote that the woods were composed of such big trees and so little underbrush, that a man may gallop a horse any way except where the streams shall hinder. Hardly anybody in England except great lords got to see places like that, and it was the ordinary habitat of the Powhatans here in Virginia. There were so many fish, especially in the spring, that the waters literally boiled with them. There were sturgeons who were tremendous fish. One fish would feed several dozen people. Sturgeon are known to get up to 800 pounds in weight. There were areas where the oysters were so thick and so extensive that they actually made islands in Hampton Roads. And the oysters themselves got to be twice the size of modern oysters, 8-10 inches long, maybe 12 inches long. There were flocks of passenger pigeons in flocks estimated at having billions of birds. It would take several hours for a single flock to pass overhead.
In fact, the wild resources were so plentiful that they essentially made farming unnecessary because they were surrounded by such natural plenty and, in fact, did not have a serious collection of protein-rich plants or crops available to them.
There was another thing that kept the Indians avid hunters, and that was that North America had very, very few domesticatable animals.
Right, that was important.
Right, the only one they used was the dog. But they didn't have cattle, horses, et cetera, not since the end of the last ice age. Deer and raccoons do not domesticate worth a nickel.
They don't pull plows.
Right? Not at all. So automatically, you've got to get your protein, your animal protein, from wild sources, and it's going to keep the men hunters.
So was this an idyllic existence? What was their average lifespan?
Well, the lifespan was not that much greater than European ones, ironically. No place has ever been idyllic as far as anthropologists have been able to discover. The life expectancy on both sides of the Atlantic was less than 40 years, but the major reasons for it were that there were still serious childhood diseases that killed children off, and there was a high mother and infant mortality. Because giving birth for the human species is difficult.
So how were they among each other? Were they endangered by each other, neighboring or distant tribes? Or did they live in harmony because everybody had plenty?
That part of the idyll didn't happen either.
Right.
People always have occasional difficulties getting along with the neighbors. And in the case of the whole eastern woodlands area from the Mississippi eastward, you have got a state of intermittent guerrilla warfare. But the Indian warfare that occurred here in the Chesapeake was not nearly as wasteful of human life. Right. Women and children were taken captive, brainwashed, and adopted into their captors' families, thereby strengthening the captors.
And only a few men, warriors, would be killed in any one battle. This was going to be completely different, of course, when the Europeans arrived.
Did the Indians initially see the Europeans as curiosities or as a threat and a danger? Were they potential friends? What was their view?
When they first met Europeans, which would be in the 16th century, they were curious. They learned pretty quickly that these people could be either friendly or threatening, and they themselves became wary.
How many Indians were here, and how often would you have seen each other? How close were the tribal villages? How many people in each?
We don't have good vital statistics from the early Jamestown years. We have only warrior counts that John Smith made. So the population estimates based on that usually range between 15,000 and 25,000 people. And that is for the whole coastal plain of Virginia and Maryland. That's not very many people, 25,000 max. But at the same time, those people were all living along the rivers, not back inland. That was foraging territory. So the riverfront towns were constantly in touch with each other. For politicking, courtship, visiting of relatives, the rivers would have been very, very busy places, and people were in constant touch with one another.
Where do we get most of our Indian history from this period? The Indians themselves say their oral traditions fairly limited.
We have a very few oral traditions that were recorded by William Strachey, and one or two by John Smith, and that was all.
Who's William Strachey?
William Strachey was a colonist who arrived in 1610 and became secretary of the colony. He had already lived in Turkey. He had a classical education, so he was actually interested in other cultures besides his own. I'd love to have known him personally. So when he had a chance to work with interpreters, they had interpreters by 1610, Indian and English ones both, he was able to ask a whole raft of questions of these people. So he became the major writer, so far as I'm concerned, about the Powhatan culture. I think what I enjoy the most about Strachey is that he actually paid attention to the women. And he is the one who records that Powhatan women had considerable sexual freedom. Strachey himself was a bit shocked by it. But the women had considerable autonomy, not only for the work that they did, but in choosing husbands or being chosen by, it was mutual. They could get divorced. You can go on and on.
Could they?
Oh, the divorce went on in the Indian world, of course.
And they could turn down suitors?
Oh, yes.
Of course.
In their writings, what do Strachey and Smith describe about the Indian lifestyle and personality that they greatly admired?
I think Smith admired the political savvy, if you will, of Powhatan. He certainly recognized that he was dealing with an equally intelligent, if not more intelligent, man.
How did Smith and Powhatan come to know each other? Why didn't they fear being murdered by each other?
They did. A relative of Powhatan, Opechancanough, captured Smith and dragged him in to meet Powhatan in Werowocomoco. So Smith was entirely in Powhatan's power when he first met him.
And had to fear for his life at every moment.
He wrote just a few months later that he was scared the whole time.
But that they had used him, quote-unquote, with what kindness they could. So he was frightened, but at the time, and of course his story changed later, but at the time he was very frank that they had in fact been quite good to him. They could have killed him, but that would not have served their purposes. They wanted to find out more about the English.
Does this culminate in the legendary story of Pocahontas, the young daughter of Powhatan, saving Smith from beheading?
The only historical record we have got of it from anybody is a single sentence in John Smith's account written 17 years later.
Single sentence?
One single sentence.
What is it?
It's a long sentence, but...
Yeah, and I haven't memorized it. Sorry. She saw that her father was about to have him killed with his head on an altar stone, and when she could not beg successfully for his life, she put her head on his, and he got a reprieve. That's basically what was said. The killing attempt in the first place made no sense in December 1607. That's no way to interrogate somebody. And at that point in time, Powhatan was dying to know a whole slew of things about these English. So why on earth kill your informant? It made no sense.
And indeed, Smith himself, when he wrote a report a few months later, actually a few weeks later, a few weeks after his release, it got sent to England a few months later, he made no reference to that. In fact, he said, as I mentioned, that they used me with what kindness they could. It was something that he said many years later when all the principals except himself were dead and could not refute the story.
This is disappointing, though, because it's an amazing story that this little girl would have put her head on his to save him?
Well, but he said that about a number of young women.
Yes, two others.
In the 1620s, he was a prolific writer and a highly entertaining one, I must say. And,
yes.
And on three different occasions, in his travels in different parts of the world, he asserted that beautiful young women had thrown themselves at him in an attempt to save him.
A 17th century rock star.
Wait, so he said repeatedly that women so
young
admired
women,
him
right,
that they saved him?
He had
yes.
been a captive in Russia and had shipwrecked in the Mediterranean, and he made up stories on each occasion that a young woman had saved him from, you know, fates worse than death in all cases.
So let's look now then at Pocahontas. She's how old when we first hear of her?
About 11.
Maybe even younger.
How old when she purportedly would have saved Smith's life, but
about
didn't.
11.
11, right, 10 or 11 when all that happened. But of course, it didn't happen, and he didn't say that it had happened at first, right?
Yeah.
So what else are we told about her? What other writing is there? We have an early witness of her frolicking in the Jamestown fort.
Right.
Then what?
All of a sudden, she is about 16 or 17. She's already married. She married a kind of a non-entity among the Indian people. And she is up on Potomac River visiting. That is where she was captured. Samuel Argall heard she was there, and he coerced the Potomac people to give her up.
So was she ransomed? Did Powhatan meet the demands?
He met part of them. And then he dawdled about the rest, and that's why she spent a year in Jamestown, during which she was converted. And with the conversion and the marriage to John Rolfe, the business of ransom became moot.
So what's all this about her being in love with John Smith?
It's complete myth. She was taken literally at gunpoint. She was virtually a prisoner for a year, although she was treated quite well. Smith was long gone. He wasn't in the colony at that time. She lived with an evangelical reverend named Alexander Whitaker. And in fact, she did not convert during that year, the first year, at the end of the year. She was put back on the same ship that had captured her with a bunch of English soldiers, and they went up the York River looking for her father because the skirmishing had gotten worse, and they were going to use her as a hostage. And in the midst of all of this, literally the battle scenes essentially that were going on, Pocahontas suddenly received a proposal of marriage from John Rolfe. Again, Smith was nowhere near, hadn't seen her since she was a child.
Why did Rolfe want to marry her?
He'd fallen in love with her, or in lust, actually.
Yeah. She may have felt real affection for him, too. Smith later asserted that John Rolfe had been her English teacher during this time, but we don't know if that is true or not. She apparently agreed to marry Rolfe, and they sent her two brothers, these emissaries, back to Poynton, and he too agreed that this would be a good idea, and that in exchange for this marriage, he would cease to make war and would turn over the weapons and all the things the English wanted. She did then, within a week, convert and then marry John Rolfe. So it seems to me, not necessarily that she did it all completely unwillingly, but that certainly she was making a political deal. After a year of living with a fervent pastor who wanted her to convert, she finally does it a few days after this political agreement is reached, the war stops, the marriage agreement is made.
Do you believe her conversion was genuine?
We can't know what she was thinking. We can never know that. But it certainly is true that at first contact, the indigenous peoples often were very willing to accept the notion of Jesus, but not necessarily as the only deity. They were accustomed to the idea that each people, each culture, had their own god, their own religious figure. And it made perfect sense that these people, these newcomers, also had a god. So it would have been entirely within the keeping of her people for her to have said, yes, I believe in Jesus. But that did not mean that in her own mind that she was necessarily rejecting her own people's religion or way of thinking about the universe or about God.
Was she widely known in England? Was she greeted as a curiosity or a celebrity, or how would you describe it?
Probably a curiosity, although one that certainly gratified the hearts of people who heard about her. She was the Indian who proved that English culture was better. She had converted.
And I think some of them were impressed and some weren't. John Chamberlain, a well-to-do bachelor who made it his business to comment on the business of others in his extensive journals, made some very snide comments about her.
What did he say about her?
Here is a portrait of No Fair Lady.
Right, because they had done an engraving of her that they were using as a pamphlet, and this was not his idea of a pretty woman, apparently. Of course, we don't know what she looked like, in fact, but the English people who dealt with her were by and large uniformly charmed. She was perceived to be witty and bright. When she had married an Englishman, the Virginia Company wanted to bring her to London as an advertisement, essentially. That was how effective they thought she would be, moving and talking and smiling in English society.
And did she die young?
It was very young. They were on their way home, and she sickened on the boat before they'd even pulled away, so they pulled into Gravesend.
And what did she die of, do you think?
I think it was bloody flux. But my evidence is circumstantial, too.
Right. I would tend to think a lung ailment, but again, it's circumstantial.
Tell me a little bit about the Pocahontas myth, how it evolved and changed to suit our understanding of the birth of our nation or who we are as a people over time.
It occurred in the early 19th century. That is, there were people in the late 18th century in Virginia who said that they were her descendants, and this was picked up on a couple of times by travelers who put into travel narratives, and those things were widely read then, and this was pre-TV. But it was in the early 19th century that this story was picked up on a big way and made its way into textbooks, newspapers, poetry, etc. It was in the very era that the stories of Betsy Ross and George Washington and the cherry tree were also born, when our country, I would say, was hungry for national myths that made it seem as though the country was deserved to be a country, was an entity, that it would succeed, that it had wonderful parts of its past that we could all be proud of. And, of course, that story was very appealing to white Americans, because it argued that a good Indian, a rational Indian, saw what was so wonderful about our arrival, had no agenda of her own, no disagreements with us, no quarrels, didn't even think about her own people's needs, but loved the English men, the English culture, and the English language, and the English God, better than she loved her own people. She was a good one. She knew what was good for her. And then we can all pat ourselves on the back. I think for that reason the story has lasted, too. It's appealing on all those levels from far more than just one generation.
Can we talk about some of the other watershed moments in the relationship between the Indians and the settlers? What about Opequan-Canoe's attack on Jamestown in 1622, for example? My understanding is Opequan-Canoe was the brother of Powhatan, and they had very divergent views and sometimes converging views on what to do with these people.
We don't know a great deal about what Opequan-Canoe thought before 1622, because he was pulling a wonderful stunt on the English. While Powhatan was alive, which means before 1618, it's almost as if you're watching the two brothers playing good cop and bad cop. Opequan-Canoe was the good cop, leading the English on and acting friendly, and Powhatan, the real power that was at the time, was more like the bad cop. And Opequan-Canoe kept that facade going right on up to 1622 until the day of the Great Assault. And one of the reasons that the English were so horrified was that they had thought that the man was their friend.
Exactly. I think Pocahontas's trip to England was probably a key event. It's clear that Powhatan sent senior advisors with Pocahontas. This was not just an advertising trip for the Virginia Company. From the Indians' point of view, they wanted to find out more. How many of these English were there? Was Jamestown just the tip of the iceberg, or was that, in fact, the best the culture could do? What was the situation? One in particular, Utamattamakan, who was an advisor to both Powhatan and later to Opequan-Canoe, is on record after his trip to England saying, "We got problems. These guys are not our friends." He could now see with his own eyes that they were completely outmanned, outgunned, outshipped on all levels, that their technology would fail to defeat the English. And in fact, that is probably why they decided to attack so soon, so quickly, within a couple of years. If there was ever a moment when the Indians could at least delay the English, it was in the beginning, before they had established themselves.
Tell me about the attack. How successful was it?
Very well timed, very well orchestrated, well planned. And in fact, would you not agree, Helen, probably about a third of the colonial population was eliminated, was killed.
But in by the rules of Indian warfare, they didn't need to wipe out everybody.
Right.
That was a European goal.
Exactly. They just needed to make the point.
Yeah.
To get out or you're going to have more problems with us.
What happened after the 1622 attack? Were there other attacks later?
Oh, yes. You see, the 1622 thing did not drive the English out, obviously. So Opequan-Canoe organized another swipe at the English in 1644, April of 1644.
About how many were killed in each attack?
300-odd. The count in 1622 was officially 347, but it probably wasn't accurate.
So what became of Virginia's Indian population after that last attack?
Oh, they got flooded out by settlers.
So they just kept moving west?
No, they didn't move west. They were left on islands here in the east.
Such as?
Such as the area called Pamunkey Neck, which had Pamunkeys, Mattaponis, and Chickahominies living in it. That remained an Indian refuge area, an official one, until 1701 when settlers were allowed in. But the reservations are still there. Indian folks generally, in Virginia at least, stayed in place.
What about disease?
No good records about it. I've scoured the county records for this kind of thing, indicating Indians were mowed down by disease, and it wasn't happening.
Don't historians say it did?
Yes, they generally do. But there are some rather good reasons why it did not. Indian people were still living in small settlements, not in cities. Mass mortality occurs in cities.
So if we had 25,000 Indians to start with, where did they go? We don't have 25,000 now.
The Indians went a number of places. Yes, a fair number of them died. Wars killed them off, too. But some of the Indian people simply spun off into English society. They became first employees and later English-style householders. That's technically called spin-off. It's an individual or family decision, and you stay right in place, but you change your ethnic identity. In the early colony, by the way, it was English who spun off into Indian society because there was more to eat there.
As we approach 2007, should we try to look at what happened as an invasion, as opposed to the conventional historical notion of arrival and the birth of a nation?
I think we should see it both ways. There are two sides. There were two sets of people in Virginia in the early Jamestown years, Native Americans and English. You cannot expect only one version to be the correct, truthful version. So far as the people native to Virginia were concerned, yes, it was an invasion, although it took several years for them to realize that an invasion is what it was because the English were lying about it. Oh, we're just visitors.
Even though, of course, each side was behaving in its own best interest, neither side was perfect, there was a grand loser here and a grand winner, and that it always behooves us to think carefully what it means to be the loser, even if we are not on that side, always behooves us to think what it feels like to be the people who are descended from the Indians or who are their cultural heirs, if you will, and not simply to celebrate it as a moment of victory, a moment of beginnings, was also the beginning of the end for many other people.
Camilla Townsend is a professor of history at Colgate University. Helen Rountree is professor emerita of anthropology at Old Dominion University. New Perspectives on Jamestown is a production of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities and was produced with the generous support of the Rosenstiel Foundation. Elliot Majerzik and Jesse Dukes are our associate producers. Andrew Windham is our executive producer. Nancy King creates our features. Jeannie Palin handles listener services, and Lydia Wilson is our publicity coordinator. For a free copy of this show on CD or to comment, call 877-451-5098. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.